We are privileged today to hear from someone who carries that story of suffering and defiance with him all the time, and one who's worked tirelessly to share it with the world. Please welcome the Ukrainian ambassador to South Africa, Oleksandr Sherba.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Oleksandr Sherba. I have been honored to serve as Ukraine's ambassador to this wonderful country for the last 5 months. I'm very honored to be here. Thank you for inviting, thank you for listening to me. I will be first reading my statement, and then hopefully we'll have an opportunity for Q&As. So, 4 years ago, Russia attacked Ukraine. The entire year before that, the world, terrified by the enormous military presence around Ukrainian border, spent begging. Can you hear me now? The entire year before attacking Ukraine, the world terrified by the enormous military presence around the border, spent begging Russia not to do it. Presidents, prime ministers, chancellors, one after another, traveled to Moscow, sat across Putin at that ridiculously long COVID-era table and tried to find a hint of hope in his eyes. He played with them all. He toyed with that hope like a cat with a mouse. Millions of lives were at stake, and he treated them like an extra thick stack of cards, which sadly does not stop many from saying now Russia got provoked and he had no other way. Curiously, very often it's the same people who 4 years ago were accusing Ukraine of warmongering and claiming that there was no chance for Russia to start something this atrocious. It was almost amazing to see many of them switch within weeks from how dare you to suspect Russia of starting a big war to, of course, Russia started the war. It had no other way. Well, it had. Putin had other way. But he chose to go to war because he thought it would be a walk in the park. Instead, it became a walk through hell with no end in sight. We see it every day in our news feed, and believe me, what you see in your news feed is just a fraction of what of the ferocity and atrocities of this war, Europe's biggest one in the last 80 years. Putin's bet in Ukraine didn't go up. He overplayed his hand. Ukraine's freedom survived, although no one believed it would. After destroying hundreds of towns and villages, after killing hundreds of thousands of people, military and civilians, Ukrainians and Russians, North Koreans and Africans, Russia has fully occupied only one of Ukraine's 24 oblasts. One out of 24. Not for the lack of trying, though, and God knows, not out of kindness towards Ukraine. All imaginable horrors of in the world, including beheadings, castrations, deliberate starvation, and currently an attempt to freeze millions to death, almost nothing was left untried in this crusade of insanity. Sadly, quite possibly with more horrors to come. And yet, the aggression got stuck, primarily because Ukrainian people turned out to be much tougher than Putin thought. Russians tend to see themselves as magnificent empire and Ukrainians as lowly peasants. Well, guess what? During this war, we saw the magnificent empire run and squeal not once or twice. Instead of flowers from civilians and surrender from the military, the invaders faced fire and endless rejection. The second reason for Putin's debacle in Ukraine was the support of people and states throughout the world who did not look away as the world's biggest nation was carving up its smaller neighbor. It became the noblest rescue operation in Europe's history. Not without self-interest, of course. Europe was protecting not only Ukraine, but also itself from someone who was not playing cards anymore and made no secret of its hostile intentions. Russia's special military operation is just a euphemism for geopolitical murder, an act of profound evil that involves illegal invasion, war of aggression, mass killings, rape, torture, looting and abductions. Standing with someone who does things like that amid the 21st century is as humanly indecent as it gets. No wonder that only the vilest and most oppressive regimes in the world chose this path. North Korea, Iran, Belarus, those who crossed the line long ago, sadly with no chance of turning back under the current dictators. Yet even now, Russia has no intention of making peace. Even with the objectives of the war missed by a mile, with half of Russian Navy gone, with a third of the strategic aviation destroyed or damaged, with almost the entire pre-war stock of tanks and armored vehicles unusable, with over a million of Russian personnel wounded or killed, with economy in stagflation, with the banking crisis looming, with ever more growing dependence on China, with deteriorating geopolitical positions throughout the world, the Kremlin still claims we haven't even started yet. So what is that about? What kind of denial is that? The answer is simple. Like every aggressor, Russia lives in a world of its own. The reality of war makes more sense for it than reality of peace, as it tickles its imperial ego and reminds the world how much suffering Moscow can unleash on others once it feels it. Feels like it. As the Russian saying goes, «Боишься, значит уважаешь». You are afraid of me, so you respect me. Yes, the world is in fear of a bigger war, and Russians enjoy every second of it. No matter how many have already perished for the sake of the voices in Putin's head, it is not really the relevant factor for Moscow. As Russian chief negotiator Medinsky said, referring to the early 18th century, we once fought Sweden for 21 years. How long are you ready to fight? So this gives you the understanding of their plans for future. In other words, what is a problem, an unspeakable tragedy for the world, is an accomplishment for Putin. Why should he deny himself and his people the pleasure of being feared again? And if this is truly Russia's logic, then what can the world do? Obviously, Ukraine will simultaneously fight and keep the doors to peaceful settlement open. Because if Ukraine stops fighting, there will be no Ukraine. If Russia stops fighting, there will be no war. And those in the world who are not fighting but cannot be friends with a geopolitical murderer will support the defense of the country attacked against the attacker. But what can Russia's friends do? Today's Russia is an addict with addiction to violence. And like in most addiction cases, one of things that might help is honesty. Not by Russia's opponents, but by its friends. After all, they get hurt by this war too. Ideally, the right and honest thing to do would be to come to Putin and to say, we are your friends, but what you are doing is not okay. Millions of lives are not a toy. If you have demands, say it and we will hear it. But you cannot just willy-nilly demand the land that is not yours. You cannot single-handedly destroy every principle upon which the world was based in the last 80 years. Respect for sovereignty, inviolability of borders, rejection of aggression, denunciation of imperialism, the list is long. Of course, the probability that Putin would listen is uncertain, unless the big countries like China, South Africa, or Brazil would join in. But it would be the moral thing to do. In justifying the unjustifiable, Russia claims that while Ukraine is backed in this war by the West, Russia is backed by the world's majority. In other words, quote unquote. In other words, it pretends to conduct this war not for the sake of its imperial comeback, but in the interest of global South. Maybe it is time to correct this distortion of facts and make clear that neutrality is not the same as the support of the war of aggression. And maybe it is time to say war of aggression not in our name. Now is the moment of truth about Russia's true objectives in Ukraine. And it is amazing how cynically put in place with the world's desire to restore peace. 4 years ago, he justified his decision claiming that Russia's legitimate strategic interests were disregarded, that NATO went too far, and the world order was unfair, implying that somehow Ukraine was a threat to Russia, not the other way around. But look what is happening now. Russia is using the so-called peace negotiations to twist everyone's arms to get more of Ukraine's territory as precondition to end the war. The territory it could not conquer in 4 years. So in the end, what was announced as resurgence against the unfair world order turned out to be a plain good old land grab, which is one more reason to draw a distinct line between this imperial war on the one side and Africa on the other. The continent that suffered too long from one sort of imperialism cannot become blunt instrument in the hands of the other. 60 kilometers, that is the progress Russia made in Donbas since the early 2023. Every centimeter of it is soaked in human blood, which explains Russia's sudden interest to recruitment in Africa. They want it to be African blood, not Russian, as simple as that. And since Russia still earns enough oil money worldwide, for now they can afford to pay for it. But it would be smart for Africans to avoid this trap, physical and moral, because even if they survive the meat grinder and come back to their families, they will come back from a war that will not make them proud, and I'm deeply convinced will not make their families happy. It will be tainted money made of the deaths of innocent Ukrainians who just wanted to live their lives on their land and be free. Invading your home, destroying your life, spilling rivers of blood, and declaring from now on what was yours is mine, this is what Russia does in Ukraine, and historically it must ring a bell for Africans who for centuries faced cruelty and audacity on the part of old empires. Well, the new empires are not much better. Seeing Africans fight and die for this insane comeback of imperialism in its cruelest, boldest form is simply wrong on so many levels. Europe and Global South, Ukrainians and Africans, we might be different. We have different historic backgrounds and skin colors. But there is something more important that connects us. We do not attack our neighbors. We respect borders. We believe in freedom, kindness, hard work, instead of worshipping the dear leader, soaking land in blood of others and looting their homes. Therefore, my appeal to South Africa is thank you to those who understand and help. And to those who don't, please look at what Russia is doing in Ukraine. What they do to us is not that different from what other empires in other time periods did to you. Please feel our pain and forgive us for every time when we did not feel yours. Thank you to President Ramaphosa for traveling to Ukraine and trying to start a peace initiative. It's not his fault that it did not bear as much fruit as we wanted, and we in Ukraine do hope that this story has not been told yet. I want to address President Ramaphosa and Minister Lamola, saying you are welcome in Ukraine, always welcome in Ukraine. If there was ever suitable time for African peace initiative, it is now. Only one political leader in the world wants this war to continue, and is the political leader who started the war. Not everybody who speaks to him because of that. But you do, so speak to him. Explain to him not only what he is doing to Ukraine or the world, he doesn't really care about that, but to his own country. Make your voice count. Every voice for peace counts, especially every word of rejection of war coming from Global South, and especially from a geopolitical giant like South Africa. Thank you. Sorry, I usually don't do this and don't read off the paper, but it was important for me to get everything verbatim.
Thank you very much. We're now going to take questions from the floor. I know that many people have very strong views about the Ukrainian-Russian war, so this is not a time to express opinions, it's time to ask questions. And we're going to start with the journalists, and then we'll move on to the floor. I do see some hands, but we'll start with the journalists.
Good afternoon, Paul Vecchiotto from Bloomberg. Mr. Ambassador, when the invasion started, the then South African Minister of Defense that evening was part of a cocktail party at the Russian embassy in Pretoria. The then International Relations Minister issued a statement calling return to borders, which was then overturned and withdrawn. So my first question is, what has happened, and your predecessor had a very difficult time getting hold of the South African government. What has changed since then, if anything? Secondly, 17 or 19 South Africans were apparently duped into going along to fight for Russia. You've sort of alluded to this. Any thoughts about any other South Africans and possibly other people from African countries? I know if there's been some from Kenya. Then
thirdly, right, you're reaching your limit, Paul.
Okay, this is the last one. Sorry, it's the last one. And then thirdly, about 25 to 30,000 Ukrainian children have been abducted from Ukraine. The South African government has said that or implied they're trying to work with the Russians to return these children. Have you any news on that? Thank you.
All right, just to recap, the first one was to do with statements around a cocktail party. Yeah. Second, Africans
third
abroad.
Since then.
Yeah. Taken to Russia, conned into combat, and the third one about the children. Okay.
Well, what changed since in the last 4 years is that South Africa in December last year for the first time voted for a Ukraine resolution and not abstained, which I think is a very positive development. What changed was that people who had illusions about Russia have now less illusions about it. I absolutely, my previous post was ambassador to Austria, and when I was nominated, my president back then, Petro Poroshenko, was criticized, why are you nominating someone who is so soft on Russia to be ambassador in such a complicated country? I was never Russia's enemy. But what happened over the last 4 years, over the last 12 years actually, because the war started not 4 years ago, was an eye-opener, and it was a moment of moment when people who had illusions about Russia, they looked like fools. And people who always were saying, sooner or later, don't be fools, sooner or later Russia will show its true face, they were the Cassandras. I think this is what is happening here. So people's eyes are opening, not as fast as we hope, but they still do. About the South Africans who were lured to fight in this imperial war, what struck me at first, I was doubtful about whether they were lured or whether it was just a pretense. But the more I read about the scandal, the more I realized that it's even more disgusting story than I thought. It was indeed people who were invited to be to study and to be the future core of pro-Russian elite in this country, who were basically thrown to the front line without really giving consent to it, and it was quite frankly as imperialist as it gets. So I hope that people in Africa, not only South Africa, in throughout Africa, understand and read. Please read yesterday's article in the Sunday Times, where they describe what their families describe what their relatives were facing in the Russian army. It wasn't good things, and it was racism. It was basically they were treated as disposable soldiers. So I think, and what was the third question?
The children.
The children. The children is a very, very touchy topic about which I cannot divulge too much details. Unfortunately, right now, as far as I understand, South Africa and Russia are in the process of, you know, comparing the list of children, abducted children that was presented by President Zelensky and the list of abducted children that Russians have. That's all I can say.
Right. I've got a question that was sent to me on behalf of one of my colleagues, Nicholas Bauer, who's a carte blanche presenter and producer in Europe. He asks, the Ukrainian government has always been deeply critical of the Russian state employing the use of civilians in the war against Ukraine, especially lately with the arrival of fighters from South Africa who were allegedly duped into action. What about Ukraine's use of the same tactics? Have you used any civilians from South Africa as part of your war effort?
Well, first of all, I vehemently disagree with the term same tactics. simply because what Russia is doing, it's paying a lot of money to people who or promising a lot of money, not paying. Again, read yesterday's piece in the Sunday Times. They sometimes people just get conned. But they promise a lot of money to people who are in financial predicaments and to countries who are in financial predicament. Ukraine's policy is we cannot pay you big money, big bucks, you know what we are fighting for. We are fighting for the right of smaller nations not to be carved up by the bigger ones. And the idea of Russia, the biggest nation in the world, covering up its neighbor doesn't sit well with so many people throughout the world. And yes, some of them decide to fight. I have read the article about these two South Africans who agreed to be medical officers with Ukraine's army. I don't know how they come. I can assure you they weren't actively pursued by Ukraine's government. I'm not sure whether being a medical officer is quite qualifies in, you know, fighting in this war. And once in all these lists that go circulate on the Telegram, I saw a South African citizen among those who died in this war. I don't know the name. I don't know how he came to fight on Ukraine's side. I just saw once, and I'm being honest about it, that I saw that number once.
Okay. Any more media questions? Nope. All right, we'll open to the floor. There's a hand over there and a hand over there. And just remember, we hear an omission of inquiry over there at the back.
Thank you, Mr. Ambassador. I recall having listened to an address from one of your previous predecessors, and the question was, what is Ukraine doing about corruption in Ukraine? Has that got any better? And the other question is, does Ukraine seek more support from the United States or the EU, or both?
Can we perhaps just be a bit more specific of what you mean about corruption? Because that's an incredibly broad subject.
What did she say? Specific about the corruption. Well, generally speaking, there was in the press considerable uncertainty and questions asked about corruption in Ukraine. Okay. Is it still there, or am I wrong?
I'll leave it to you to answer that.
Well, I can assure you, unfortunately, the corruption in Ukraine is still there. Like in every other country in the world, nobody is free of that, but that's not reasons to attack any country of the world. I can also assure you that the biggest desire of Ukrainians and of Ukrainian people is to become a better nation, and that includes getting clean, going clean of this, you know, sin, which is corruption. And that's why we had two revolutions within one decade. The desire is enormous. And every day I receive, statistics about what has been done on the front of fighting corruption. I won't bore you with these statistics. Quite frankly, I don't have them in head about, you know, all the legislations that we have passed, and we have passed already on our way to, you know, European integrating with the European Union. For instance, but believe me, European Union first and Ukrainian public, Ukrainian civil society second, making huge, you know, pressure on everyone in the government to do something tangible about it. So that's my answer to your question. Yeah.
And then the support?
The support from America and from the United States and European Union, definitely. We need that support. We hope that America will finally stop appealing to the good side of President Putin's when it comes to Ukraine, because we know for sure there is no good side in President Putin when it comes to Ukraine. And we do hope that the European Union will learn to be not only decent and passionate about freedom, but also a little bit more courageous.
All right, there was next question.
Hi there. My name is Peter Becker. Thank you, Mr. Ambassador. I'd like to ask if you have any advice for corporations who are thinking of doing business with Russian companies, in particular state-owned enterprises in South Africa, and in particular Rosatom. The Nuclear Energy Corporation of South Africa is thinking of buying a reactor, and also there's been a lot of talk about nuclear power in this country and possibly buying from Russia. And because enterprises or corporations respond better or are more concerned about financial risk, I think the moral risks are clear, but could you perhaps give them advice in terms of financial risk? Thank you.
God, about financial risks, you should talk about people who are in charge of that in Kyiv and in Washington and in Brussels. We have in the room the president of Ukraine Association of Ukrainians in South Africa, Dvinka Kachur, who is actually expert on energy and nuclear energy. So you can discuss with her afterwards how Russia is using Rosatom as really a universal weapon and universal tool to enter any market possible, any region possible. Unfortunately, it hasn't been stopped yet, but from what I read and from what I hear in Europe, finally Europe is inching closer and closer to really doing something about the Rosatom problem. And about everyone else who is doing business in circumvention of international sanctions, they should know that, morally, they are earning money off killing of Ukrainians, and B, there is a chance that it might be known to a broader audience and to governments throughout the world, and that would be not the proudest moment for them.
All right, next question.
It's Nikki Westcott here. Good afternoon, Ambassador. I wanted to ask you a strategic question, and that is it not on? Oh, can you hear me now?
Yeah.
It concerns how those in authority in Ukraine perceive Trump's strategy in relation to his overt backing of Russia. Is it in the interests of trying to promote and maintain a multipolar world with Russia as a structural part of that? Or what is Trump's end game here in backing Russia?
You know, the position of Ukraine's ambassador in South Africa has many perks. And one of them is I'm not the Ukraine's ambassador in Washington. I'm not in the business of commenting on America's foreign policy. I hope you understand.
All right, another question over there. Paul Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Ambassador, for coming all the way to Cape Town to speak to us. We appreciate it. My question is something we haven't touched on yet, but it does have to do with South Africa. As you know, there's a case pending in the International Court of Justice between South Africa and Israel in which genocide against the Palestinian people is alleged. From Ukraine's point of view, what is the optimal outcome of that litigation? Thank you.
You know, I used to serve in Germany for quite a while as a young diplomat, and one of the leading politicians back then said the main rule of politics is never answer hypothetical questions. So I can tell you what Ukraine's position of Palestine is, and it's definitely this war has to come to an end, and the suffering of civilians has come to an end. Just like we recognized in the suffering of Israelis on October 7th, what Russians were doing to Ukraine in the early days of the war, now we recognize in the suffering of some of Palestinian people who get bombarded, the suffering of people in many Ukrainian cities. So please don't make us choose sides whose pain is harder for us. We feel for both sides. And for years we have had our diplomatic representative envoy in Ramallah For years, we have been supporting the two-state solution. For years, we have been actively trying to, you know, to expand our diplomatic relations with the Arab countries. I 20 years ago, I remember even at the moment when Ukraine appointed a special envoy on reconciliation between Israel and Palestine. So we have done a lot. We feel the pain of Palestinian people, just like we feel the pain of the relatives of the hostages and of those who died on October 7th.
Any more questions? Okay, I see two hands, blue over there, blue shirt.
Thank you. My name's Alan Lindhorst. I often wondered how Winston Churchill would have responded to Putin's aggression. And I think he would have done so the same way he responded to Hitler when he invaded Poland. And I'm just wondering whether, will the time come when Western nations will actually take a stand and support Ukraine more active, not just supplying weapons, but actually siding with them in this war against Russia, or whether they're too frightened it's going to provoke a global Holocaust?
Is that classified as a hypothetical question?
Absolutely, 100%. Yeah, but again.
So there was a question
about Churchill,
about the courage of Europe and whether or not there would be a kind of a replay of what happened with Winston Churchill in relation to Germany in the Second World War.
I would say Europe is learning how to be courageous. And it is stunning to me to see how the people of Great Britain recognized in Ukraine 2022 Great Britain of 1940, when the whole world didn't believe that they stood a chance, and the whole world was trying to break their will to stand their ground. And then this courageous man comes and says, "We will fight them on the beaches." He is missed, of course, he is missed a lot, but I do hope that Europe is learning how to be a little bit more Churchillian and less what's the name of the other guy? Neville Chamberlainian.
All right, another question over there.
Afternoon, Ambassador. Thank you very much for taking the time to come and speak to us this afternoon. It's greatly appreciated. My name is Tracy Babb. I'm going to ask you the same question I asked your predecessor a year ago. When will Ukraine hold democratic elections to elect a new president? It's long overdue, probably 2 years overdue now.
Well, clearly, legally, the elections should have been held one year ago, according to the constitution, but also according to the constitution, during the wartime, there is no way to hold presidential elections. And I ask myself, how would we hold elections in the parts of Ukraine which are bombarded daily? How do we gather people and persuade people together to come together, knowing that Russian drones are flying over their heads? So there should be some minimal precondition passed and created before the decision on democratic elections is made. You know that Ukraine is a very specific country. We almost never re-elect our presidents. We always elect our presidents with, you know, enthusiasm, and with the even bigger enthusiasm, we elect someone new in 5 years. This is the part probably of Ukrainian character. I'm not sure whether this will be the case this time around, because President Zelensky is extremely popular in Ukraine, but with Ukraine, you can never know, and everybody understands this. We are the true democracy, and believe me, we understand there are no bigger critics of Ukraine than Ukrainians. If you have spent one evening with a Ukrainian drinking something stronger than Coca-Cola, you will know that. One of the things that people love to do is conducting truly free and independent elections. And it will be definitely the case once the conditions are there.
So there's a question here with Anthony.
Ambassador, I wanted to follow up on the on your answer about the Genocide Convention. And many South Africans have observed that South Africa has a case at the ICJ concerning Israel's behavior in Gaza, and that Ukraine has a case in the ICJ concerning Russia's behavior in Ukraine, and that neither country supports the case of the other. And you have mentioned sympathies for the people of Israel, but I don't think the genocide case concerns the people of Israel. It concerns the government of Israel in the same way that your genocide case does not concern the people of Russia, for whom I think we should also feel sympathy. It concerns the government of Russia. And so I wondered if you could explain why these two countries do not support one another's cases. Is this a matter of purely political calculation, or is there some difference of interpretation of the nature of the Genocide Convention and how it should be used?
First of all, about the lack of support, well, you should address this question to Prime Minister Netanyahu, who has a very special relationship with Putin, as we know. And I think he grants more trust to this person than Putin deserves. That's one thing.
Well, it was about the difficulty, the seemingly contradictions between the two positions. And
it's I don't think it's a legal question, quite frankly. You're putting me in a very hot water here. Yeah? Please don't. So we did a lot to dissuade the leadership of Israel what they think of Putin or how trustful they find Putin. I'm not sure whether we have succeeded so far.
Maybe that's something for a discussion afterwards. Are there any more questions? Okay. Have you already had a bite? Yeah, you've already asked a question. I think that the question's going over there.
Sure. Hi, Ambassador. I'm Colin. I'm the British Consul General here, and I'm very proud to sit with all my other colleagues from Europe and other parts of the world who have been on a journey, as you say, of how to support Ukraine at this time. I recognise I've been a diplomat for over 20 years, and lots of us at this table will have dealt with lots of different issues over our time, but they're often a sort of a policy issue or a tourism issue. We don't often deal with things that profoundly affect our friends, our family, the future of our country, the lives of our families. And I just have a bit of a personal question about how do you reconcile this in your day-to-day job, the horrors of what's happening in your country, almost certainly to your friends, to your family there, whilst being overseas and constantly talking about it, constantly having to defend your position against Russian disinformation in South Africa, in other places that you've been. How have you, on this journey of the last 4 years, find your way to have the daily strength to do this? And I'm sorry that's quite a personal question, but it really interests me to the admiration I have for you and your predecessor to do what you do on a day-to-day basis. How have you found a way to do that?
Well, it's not easy, and it's not getting easier with time. Almost every day begins with a call with my parents, who happen to live next to one of the objects against which Russian missiles and drones fly every night. I tried to get my parents to come here, but my parents are in their 80s. They are very stubborn. My dad, the most peaceful person in the world, dug out from somewhere in the basement a rifle. And has his rifle by his bed. Ever since Russians were standing 20 kilometers from Kyiv, and I asked him, what's your plan? What are you planning to do with this rifle? And he says, when they come, I will take at least two of them with me. So, I have a friend who was ambassador to one of important countries whose dad was killed. He was a little bit young, in his 70s, in the first months. And this colleague, she told me, you don't want to know. We have Bogdan Dyachenko, our diplomat, whose home in Donetsk, his family lost everything. He basically lost his home because of Russians and because of this invasion. So we have a lot of stories to tell. Hopefully the time will come when we will tell them without tears in our eyes. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I think on that note, we are going to end this. I'm sure you will be available to take questions from people, have a little conversation one-on-one. We have a present for you, which we'd like you to unwrap right now and show everybody.
You were drawing it, right? Wow, thank
you.
This is very, very flattering. Thank you so much. My wife always says, your nose is too long. She will laugh.
And I'll just finish off. Oh, there we go. All right, so thank you very much, everybody, for coming. I'm sure you can come and ask extra questions directly once we've finished. Just to remind you of upcoming functions, on the 26th of February, which is just around the corner, we're going to have a post-budget networking event at 6 Spin Street, which will be free of charge for everybody. Come and have snacks and drinks to discuss the fallout from the budget. 13th of March, we'll have the economist Iraj Abedian, who will talk about why won't South Africa condemn Iran's brutal suppression of popular dissent. And then the relatively newly appointed rector and vice chancellor of the University of Stellenbosch, Duresh Ramajagannath, will come to talk to us on the 27th of March after his first year in that position. So have a good afternoon and thank you for coming. You've got one more thing to say. Yes, sure.
I completely forgot. Ukrainian community here in Cape Town is conducting tomorrow a viewing of a heartbreaking but important documentary about what's happening in Kherson. What's happening in Kherson is a so-called human safari. Russian drone operators use Kherson civilians to train their abilities to strike moving objects. So it's a horror that's going on for months already, when civilians just get struck every day. Please don't ignore it. There is a leaflet about that when you go out. And in early March, on March 2nd, 4th, and 3rd and 4th, there will be three concerts of one of prominent Ukrainian piano players, organ players. I don't know what he doesn't play, Taras Filenko, and it will be in commemoration of this sad anniversary that will be tomorrow. Thank you.
Thanks very much. All right, everybody. Goodbye.